Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with Associate Dean and Associate Professor Leah Plunkett at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law about her new book, Sharenthood. That's right, Sharenthood, not Parenthood, but Sharenthood. Why we should think before we talk about our kids online. As a parent, as a new grandparent, I think about these things quite a bit, and I do recognize that these are major issues. I can't not really wait to have this conversation with Leah Plunkett. I think that there are so many fascinating things that we get to explore and help us all figure out how to be better stewards of our children's privacy and information. First, though, we're going to actually talk about some research that matters. And the very first one is one I think virtually all parents are going to be interested in, but it's research that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association Open Network. They have a new journal, and it's about a possible link between C-sections and autism. And before we even go further, we should say this is not causal. It's not that C-sections cause autism, but this is actually data from 61 studies. It's called a meta-analysis. It's that big data. You put it all together, you put it in that cook pot, you apply very strong statistical tests, and you say, you know, this meta-analysis is really putting together all these studies to try to come up with something that may be important. And in this particular case, they found that having had a birth by C-section was associated with a 33% higher risk of autism and a 17% higher risk of attention deficit disorder in the child. Again, observations, important to think about, is there something there? What does this really mean? And I think the researchers who were in Stockholm, who were the first authors, they really are experts in understanding and looking at these associations between cesarean section and long-term health problems. We do know that C-section rates have increased in the United States. And there are big differences. The C-section rates are highest in the South, up to a third, lower in other sections of the country, but at least a fifth. So this is a frequent event. And if there is an association there, it is an infrequent event because C-sections are frequent. Autism is not frequent, but we don't really have causes that we are fully aware. We know that there's some genetic aspects. I think this is the sort of thing that you are not in control most times whether or not you get a cesarean section. It's there for the life of the mother, life of the child, and making those decisions with providers. But I do think it's something that you could talk with your prenatal provider about. Ask them to talk about this research with you, and I think become a better informed consumer and parent. Our next research that matters is really quite interesting. It's about cognition or memory problems. We know, and we've talked about on the show many times over the years, about Alzheimer's disease, vascular dementia, the dementia from the hardening of the arteries as people get older or have these little small strokes. And there's something that kind of comes before both of those, and that is what's called mild cognitive impairment. And it could be an early sign of Alzheimer's or other types of dementia. It's sometimes seen in people who have sleep problems, other chronic illnesses, depression, sometimes side effect of medication. So this is something that's important, and it seems to sometimes really be associated with later problems. The question is, what do we know about what we can do about it? And we've never really screened for it. Usually it's when someone comes into the office and the parent or the child or the sibling or the spouse says, I'm worried about someone and their memory, and then we will test for it. What this research from the American Academy of Neurology says that they actually are recommending that physicians do a complete cognitive assessment on people age 65 and older for memory problems to help may be diagnosed mild cognitive impairment in people who haven't previously been diagnosed with it. This was published in the journal Neurology, which is the medical journal of the American Academy of Neurology. And they come up with a calculator, a qualitative measure tool to help figure out how to do this, suggesting that it should be done. I imagine many people might agree and may come into their doctors asking for that. One of the questions, though, is what did the expert who come up with guideline recommendations say, the Preventive Services Task Force? What they actually say is there's not enough evidence for or against to recommend this at this point in time. So I think we have some conflicting guidelines here. One of the reasons is, in most cases, there are nothing we can actually do to maybe prevent that from going further. And unless we actually have techniques to actually improve from a screen, a lot of times we won't necessarily recommend a screen. There are false positives, false negatives, perhaps complications and consequences for insurance or other elements about making these sorts of things, driving implications on how people may feel. Maybe they could implicate some outcomes, like people who might feel hopeless, thinking that some bad things are going to happen. So I think this is an interesting and important question. I think it's the start of a conversation. This is not the end of a conversation. Informed decision making really does need to occur, and hopefully we can get a little more clarity as we go along. Our very last research that matters is a research that actually came out of the UNC, University of North Carolina School of Global Public Health, and it's really about overcrowded emergency departments. And this research actually says how emergency rooms who are dealing with overcrowding, does it actually affect their core performance measures? Would it affect wait time, how long you're staying in the emergency room? Once you have been discharged, how long it takes you to get out? How long it takes you to get in the hospital if you need to be admitted? And how many people leave without being seen? I think it's intuitive to say if you're more crowded, those things all get worse. And the short answer is it does. And these researchers analyzed over 1.18 billion visits. Yes, 1.18 billion visits. That means some people are going more than once to the emergency room over about 8-year period of time, and really trying to better understand the factors that can help emergency rooms, hospital planners, healthcare systems better deal with improving quality, decreasing wait times. I can tell you one thing that's helped in the University of North Carolina system. The system in my department, family medicine, opened up an urgent care in our family medicine department. We are open after hours, during regular hours, Saturdays, Sundays, urgent care. Things that may have shown up in the emergency room that didn't need to be seen in the emergency room can be offloaded into an outpatient setting, and that really opens up the emergency room beds for people who really may need those emergencies. Making greater access for patients, I think, helps all of us, particularly those who may need the emergency room. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Leah Plunkett, Associate Dean and Associate Professor at the University of New Hampshire, Franklin Pierce School of Law, about her new book, Sharenthood. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and today on Conversations, we actually have the pleasure of talking with Leah Plunkett, Associate Dean and Associate Professor at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law, about her new book, Sharenthood: Why Should We Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online? Welcome to Your Health, Leah.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
And I must say, we could go on for hours. This is such an important, fascinating conversation, and we're going to dive into it in just a minute. But I think for our guests, it's not often that we have lawyers on a health show. But I do think it's important to understand a little bit about you. Tell us a little bit about your path and how you became interested, I would say, in an issue that is a cross-cutting issue across all disciplines.
Thank you, Adam. Well, my interest actually grew out of cross-cutting identities, so it's very fitting to have a cross-cutting interest across disciplines. The two prongs for me that really informed this research were, first and foremost, becoming a parent myself within the last 10 years to now two young children, and simultaneously joining the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard as a researcher with their youth and media team. And I started looking a lot at privacy laws, first as they related to students specifically, but then more broadly to young people. And I became increasingly interested in / concerned about what I was choosing to do in my own life as a new parent in terms of sharing my kids' digital data and trying to figure out, Adam, really the best way for me and my husband initially to navigate it in our own lives. And then I became interested in having a broader conversation with folks, not just lawyers, but with people everywhere about whether, when, how, and why we share it or don't share it.
Really important. And I imagine as you had your children, and my children were born before digital age, but during that first 10 years, digital ages started coming on board, that people are so excited to share. That seems to be a natural, overwhelming impulse. What made you think that there was a lot more to this? Because I think for most people, when we have something wonderful in our lives, we just want to share it.
And I think that impulse to connect is a profoundly good one. I certainly don't want to, in any way, shape, or form, criticize that impulse or really even question it, because I think inherently it's a good thing to want to reach out to family and friends and communities and other networks to say, hey, this amazing thing is happening. And really, I don't think there's anything more amazing than becoming a parent. I'm not a grandparent yet, but maybe that will give becoming a parent a run for its money. But otherwise, I'm not seeing anything. But what I did want to query, and I do in the book, is whether sharing that kind of good news digitally was the healthiest approach that we could take in terms of not just our children's privacy, but also their current and future life opportunities that could be impacted by choosing to follow through on that sharing impulse in a digital way as opposed to a brick-and-mortar way.
Well, let's deconstruct what you just said, because I think each of them is important. And you've raised the question about legal issues. I know just from some experience that it's complex posting pictures of people less than age 18 without their permission. There are legal issues. Help us understand what those are.
Absolutely. You're right to think like that. I think a lot of people don't, actually. So when you are talking about children's private data, and pictures are included in that, in most circumstances, the legal ability to consent or not consent really is going to be with the parent or guardian rather than with the child. There are some exceptions to that, such as when the law would delegate decisions about whether and why to share to another institution like a school. So there are times when a school can share personally identifiable information, or PII, to really nerd out, and they can do that without getting parental consent. But most of the time, these kinds of sharing decisions, the law would actually give to the parent or guardian of the child rather than to the child himself, herself, or themselves.
We can come up with our own weird acronyms in medicine, HIPAA being one that has nothing to do with an animal, but everything to do with the privacy. And we know that when we're sharing healthcare privacy and we're seeing an adolescent and what things we actually can and can't share with the parent at what age, and it's not like, you know, oh, it's 18 where the child actually has some control over their health information. So I don't know if in the same, in the digital world, is it the same way? Is it 18 or is it less than 18?
When you were talking about whether or not to share digital information that you get directly from a child, so as opposed to a parent wanting to say something about a child, there are some different ages you need to look at. So CAPA, to use another acronym, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, controls when a commercial software, that includes app providers, can get personal information directly from a child under 13. In that instance, to get that information directly from a child, you need parental consent until the child is 13. Once the child is 13 and over, CAPA recommends but does not require parental consent in that particular realm. So that is the biggest way in which our federal privacy laws, as they relate to digital engagement as opposed to healthcare engagement, would draw a line that's different from 18. But, and I think this is an important distinction from something like HIPAA, CAPA does not attempt to regulate parents' decisions about whether or not to share information about their kids of any age. So a parent could still take a picture of a 14-year-old and put it on Facebook without the law requiring Facebook or the parent to get the child's permission. I think that is different from HIPAA.
So we're talking with Associate Dean and Associate Professor Leah Plunkett at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law about her new book, Sharenthood. And you mentioned also that this could have really dramatic impacts on future and life opportunities. Give us some examples where people would say, I hadn't thought of that.
So when I think about current and future life opportunities, I'm thinking about the ways in which the private information we share about our kids can be used for other people to take actions regarding them now or in the future. And a big way that I think we are not appreciating how digital information sharing can have an impact is when you think about data brokers. So the Center for Law and Information Policy at Fordham Law School released a great paper about a year or so ago where it managed to buy some commercial lists or selects, which I guess is marketing for a subset of a list, what about a dozen data brokers had for sale about children. And Adam, the lists are pretty staggering. You have Rich Kids of America, Homeschool Kids of America, really granular information about children's intimate characteristics. And we don't know at this point, because we don't have comprehensive federal or state laws in place that regulate data brokers, we don't know how they're getting all of this information. We hope and expect that they're not getting it from sources that are protected by privacy laws that relate to certain sectors, like HIPAA relating to healthcare providers or FERPA relating to schools. But we actually aren't quite sure.
Explain, though. I think we recognize, most of us, that there's so much information about us that's publicly accessible. And some baseline information about our children is probably there. But our parents putting things on there like, so proud that my child made it through surgery, or yes, my child's struggling right now. Or is there that type of things that people are sharing, and that's then the major concern?
Absolutely. Parents will share very intimate things on social media. And Adam, I think what is more disturbing to me will be the intimate things that parents reveal about their kids that they don't necessarily realize that they're revealing. So an example of that would be anytime you have a smart device in your home. So you have a smart refrigerator or a sensor-enabled baby booty, which is a real product. Or actually, after I wrote the book, Pampers released a smart diaper. I was so bummed. It came out after I finished the manuscript. I couldn't include it. But you're seeing products now that are in kids' bedrooms and on their bodies and in their kitchens that are picking up really detailed and really personal information about them. And that type of information is what really freaks me out, because there are virtually no safeguards or easy forms of transparency into what those commercial providers are doing with that information or what they may choose to do with it in the future. So I think that it's very reasonable, and not at all the stuff of science fiction, for us to assume as parents or grandparents or other invested adults that the kinds of information that we're sharing, if let's say we monitor our kids' urine output by a smart diaper, could be aggregated and reshared and analyzed tomorrow, next year, 5 years from now, and possibly used to make data-driven predictions by gatekeepers to employment, to credit, to life insurance, and so on. So that's the stuff that really gives me a lot of pause.
Yeah, it's starting to keep me up tonight, and that hasn't even occurred yet. You've definitely awoken me and a little bit scared me, but we're going to need to take a short break. When we return, we're going to actually continue talking with our guest, Leah Plunkett, who is Associate Professor and Associate Dean at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law, about her new book, Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. We'll be right back with your health. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We've been talking with Associate Dean and Associate Professor at the University of New Hampshire, Franklin Pierce School of Law, Leah Plunkett, about a fascinating new book called Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. And Leah, before the break, I think we got a good understanding of some of the legal definitions, some of the kind of legal concerns, some of the privacy concerns, some of the beginning to understand some of the worries that could keep one up at night that most people probably have no knowledge of, these smart diapers that you were talking about. I'm like, oh, wow, I guess I can tell when you poop or don't poop or, you know, or who knows. I mean, it's just kind of scary. And I wonder, help us understand, what is the scope of what your book is trying to achieve? Walk us through that a little bit.
Thanks, Adam. My book is trying to be a conversation starter because I think that most of us don't know the full scope of what we are sharing digitally about the kids in our lives, often without meaning to. And most of us also have not necessarily taken the time to reflect on whether that sharing, or sharenting, as the book calls it, is beneficial. And so, above all else, this book is hoping to be a way for parents, grandparents, educators, coaches, etc., to have a conversation about their own understandings of privacy in their homes or their schools, to develop an informed sense of what the law does or does not regulate in terms of youth privacy, and then does provide some guidance in terms of a thought compass at the end of the book for overarching principles or values that we could all keep in mind when we're making our digital tech decisions for the kids in our lives.
Yeah, what an important depth of topics to cover. And I just think, you know, I just became a grandparent a few weeks ago, and I began to think in my conversations right as the baby was born, because you're right there and you're wanting to take pictures and you're wanting to like immediately get them posted. But I told those around me, these aren't our pictures to share. How do we begin to have conversations with parents? Are there best practices here that you talk about in the book, or you can share a little bit of how we begin to have those conversations?
Absolutely. I think that it's really important for families to try to develop a family digital privacy plan. I think that we are seeing a lot of great movement around families developing screen time plans. I know the American Academy of Pediatrics has one available, but I have not yet seen a sort of mainstream acceptance of this idea of a family privacy plan. And I recommend to people that they have exactly the kind of conversation that seems like you kicked off with the people around you of, hey, you know, we have this child in our midst. How do we understand privacy? And for folks who are actually going to have the bandwidth to spend even a few minutes writing something up, I suggest proceeding at three levels. The first level would be a level of principle or value. So one of the values and principles I really double down on in the book is this idea that we should all value play, that childhood and adolescence needs to be a time to make mischief and make mistakes and grow up the better for having done that. So that would be a principle that a household might have, that we value play. The next level would be a rule of the road about how you would implement protection of that principle. So a rule of the road might be, we don't post pictures or videos on social media of our children when they are goofing around or playing pretend or playing outdoors. Whatever they are doing to play, maybe we'll take a picture and, you know, text it to a grandparent, but we're not going to put it on social media. And then that final level would be an example of a specific prohibition or requirement. So a specific prohibition might be absolutely no pictures posted of children playing on the beach or in the bath or in the sprinkler or in any stage of undress. And so I think that if parents and grandparents and other adult caregivers make these digital privacy plans and proceed at the level of principle, rule of the road, and specific examples, that can go a long way to making these kinds of conversations as familiar to all of us as whether somebody has an allergy and therefore we need to avoid peanuts. I think it really needs to become as mainstream and accepted as those kinds of child welfare conversations.
It's making explicit, at least not letting it be reactive, but being proactive. I love that. I remember my daughter telling me once how important it was to get permission before any picture we take that involves her is a posted picture. And I didn't get it at first, but the more I began to think about it, it's like it's my camera, but it's her body, you know, or his body or their mm-hmm. body. And I think mm-hmm. perhaps with the kids, and I don't know if this is really in the book, that they don't really have that ability to express that.
And I love the example you just gave. Kids of different ages have different abilities, but the law does not give them any meaningful say whatsoever. So unless a parent is going to be posting a picture that would violate some type of law of general applicability, so a criminal law, let's say, you cannot post a picture of you abusing or neglecting your child and then say, oh, well, I could choose to post that. No, you violated criminal law, and the law enforcement will hopefully come after you. But really short of that, the law lets parents decide. And so I think your example is a really powerful one. And I would put that into a family privacy plan where the principle or value at the top would be consent. The rule of thumb would be always involve a child in whatever way is age appropriate in a digital privacy decision. And then the specific example would be don't post a picture without asking first. And I do think that even pretty young kids have the ability to weigh in on that picture posting question.
In medicine, we say, you know, in ethics, the sunshine test. Are you okay with whatever it is you're about to talk about being on the front page of the newspaper and being disclosed
exactly.
to the world? And if the answer is no, exactly. you probably shouldn't do it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that would be a great family digital privacy plan. Are you comfortable with what you're putting on social media being captured in a screenshot? So even if you set your friend circle to private, assume that it could be captured in a screenshot and posted without any privacy controls by any one of those people who sees it. Or somebody who's not one of those people who sees it if one of your friends leaves an account unattended. And if the answer is no, if you would not want a social media post to appear on the internet without any privacy controls, you absolutely should not put it on social media, even if you think your privacy settings will protect you.
So as we finish up in just a few seconds, is there any final word you'd like our listeners to know? And I should say before you finish that we will make the link for your book, Sharing to It, available to our listeners. I encourage listeners to maybe get the book, maybe if you have an older child, maybe read the book together and go over. And I love this family digital privacy plan. We're going to have a discussion of that at our next family vacation.
Thank you. I'll be curious to hear, if it's not private, what you folks come up with. I think what I would leave people with Adam, would be a bit of a thought experiment for those of us who are parents or grandparents who were not born digital, which is, if you're thinking of sharing something and your parent had chosen to share that about you in a local newspaper or, you know, in front of a PTA meeting, would you have been upset? And if the answer is yes, if your 12-year-old self would have been upset to have your parent take out an ad in the local newspaper and congratulate you on getting your first period, then don't put it up on social media and embarrass your kids the same way.
Has anyone ever done that?
Not in my own social network. I have definitely seen publicly available YouTube videos of moms talking about their daughter's first period.
Well, I think we have a new digital sunshine test that your book is going to make a big difference in asking questions and getting us all thinking. I want to thank you, Leah Plunkett, Associate Dean and Associate Professor at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law, about writing your new book, Sharenthood, and sharing your journey and helping all of us share a journey to help us think and talk before we post.
I had a wonderful time talking with you. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. But first, Laura, I've got to say congratulations.
Thank you.
You had something important happen in your life
recently,
yes?
Well, yes, I became a mom. I have a baby.
Woohoo!
Yeah, she's almost approaching 3 months old now, so.
So this conversation with Leah Plunkett about Sharenthood is one that you take to heart.
Very much so. We actually have been a little bit negligent about posting photos online, which I was kind of feeling guilty about, but this conversation makes me feel much less guilty about not sharing it with my social network.
Yeah, and I think having become a grandparent about the same time,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, you know, like people say, why haven't you shared more pictures? And I just like, well, they're not really my pictures to share. So
right.
I think both of us are learning together.
And yeah, wrestling
that was
with that.
A helpful conversation that we had earlier.
For sure. I think
well,
so, too.
It's great to have you back.
Thank you. Thank you. Likewise.
What's our very first House Call question today?
I recently had some elevated blood pressure for the first time in my life. I am now 60 and had not seen a doctor in 3 years, and it had never happened previously. Rather than put me on medication, however, the doctor asked if I'd be willing to commit to losing 10 pounds in 3 months, thinking this would lower my blood pressure. I thought this was a reasonable request, and lo and behold, I went from 150 over 92 to 134 over 74. Both myself and the doctor are thrilled with these results, and I thought patients might like to know that weight loss can be an alternative to medication sometimes.
Ding, 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 ding,
yeah.
Ding, ding. I think we're going to give a prize to this listener and to the provider.
Mm-hmm.
Because here, you know, we had a patient that come in with what we call mild hypertension. There's undoubtable mild hypertension. It hasn't been in for a while. And most of us, as we get older, we sometimes will gain weight each year a little bit. And here someone said, let's stop what may be leading to this blood pressure elevation in this particular patient. Let's try to reverse it first, because it wasn't like the doctor saying, let's wait 3 years.
Right.
They said 3 months and gave a very concrete goal, lose 10 pounds, which for most people might be 5% body weight. But it turns out that if you do 5% body weight loss, it has significant positive impacts on blood sugar, on blood pressure in this particular case.
That's a pretty big drop for, you know, just 10 pounds.
Yeah, I think it's impressive. I think increasingly trying some of these measures that have been proven to work. I mean, this was not an unproven strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I do think this was great. I want to give credit to the patient who really did this, but also the provider who worked with them.
Great.
What's our very next House Call?
I was recently in the hospital with chest pain and fatigue. The doctors did cardiac tests that included a heart catheterization and said that it was not my heart. They sent me home, and while I was reassured to hear it wasn't my heart, it seems no one bothered to tell me what it actually was that was causing the problem. I went to see my primary care physician, and after an hour visit and talking about the losses I've experienced over the past years, including two sisters and two close friends, it appears that I'm dealing with unresolved grief. It's good to have some idea of why things are occurring, even if they're not easy to fix.
Well, what an important story to share. I remember so well in my training, I would be on a rotation and someone would come in with chest pain and we would tell them the next day,
right,
it's good news, it's not a heart attack. And everyone was all real happy. And then we would walk on.
Yeah.
And I kept, like, as I ever walked, I thought, what was it?
Yeah. Can I have a little more information?
And here I was a medical student. And, you know, I thought, well, maybe it's just because I just didn't know enough, that everyone knew something that I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, what was the secret?
Right.
And it turns out that doctors are much better about saying what someone doesn't have than what they have, because it sometimes is difficult. I mean, in this particular case, it appears that pretty progressive loss, grief, led to some pretty significant physical symptoms.
Well, and I'm struck by the fact that, you know, this says after an hour visit with the primary care physician that it took that amount of time to sort of come to that realization, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that quote-unquote value-based care.
Yeah.
We talked, we had Dr. Mark Gwynn on here not too long ago talking about how we're looking for that value.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less about procedures and more about understanding and the relationship and figuring things out, that there is a tremendous value in that continuity relationship between a provider and a patient over time. A provider who's willing to work with the patient and take whatever time. Maybe it's 10 minutes at six visits that got us to this, or maybe it's one visit for 60 minutes.
But for that patient, what a relief to have some sort of idea of what they can pin this scary symptom on.
Right. And there's value in knowing that you don't have a blockage. Believe me, I think I would want to know that right off the bat. So I think both groups of providers have done their job, and both are highly valuable.
Yeah.
What's the very last house call?
I was recently on a riverboat in California, and on docking at the return, we heard that there was a case of flu among the passengers. I hadn't thought anything about it until 2 days later when I came down with a fever and a cough. I had had a flu shot, so I thought it was unlikely to be the flu, but I saw my doctor, who also diagnosed me with the flu. He recommended I take an anti-flu medication. This seems really early in the season for the flu.
How unlikely it is both to get the flu this early in the season, to get it after you've had a flu shot, and to get it when you had an exposure on a riverboat.
Well, yeah.
Good news is the doc diagnosed it early, and my guess is you are elderly enough or have some physical conditions that the doctor thought you would benefit from taking a medication. Mm-hmm. So you got diagnosed early. Everyone getting good treatment, done the right way. You know, it's a good outcome. You know, the flu shot is clearly not always effective. We know it's sometimes 60%, so it can be more or less depending on the season. We don't know what it is going to be this season, but it tells us it could be bad because it's starting early.
Have I heard, and tell me if this is true, that if you do have the flu shot, even if you get the flu, sometimes it can make it less severe, or is that something I'm making up?
No, I think that there are two things. One is that, let's say within a school system, if like, you know, 90% of the kids get a flu shot, then the likelihood of it getting spread more just goes down to what's called herd immunity.
Right.
And then I do think that you get a reduction in upper respiratory infections of all kind during flu season. So again, it may or may not be that the flu may not be as bad. It may not be, but you might get some other very subtle benefits that give you some protection, which I think is great.
Okay, great.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can share any questions by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Leah Plunkett. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking with you next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.